The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Number one social problem in America is what I call the epidemic of fatherlessness.
Yes.
70% of Black kids are raised today without a father in the home, married to the mother, up from 25% back in 1965. Now 25% of white kids enter the world without a father in the home, married to the mother. 40% of all American kids do. And the numbers are clear. If you are raised without a father, you're 5 times more likely to be poor and commit crime, 9 times more likely to drop out of school, and 20 times more likely to end up in jail.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we have got on a legendary guest. I feel like this podcast and conversation is long overdue. He is a longtime radio and TV host. He is a former candidate for both California governor and U.S. presidency. And he is also the author of the latest book, As Goes California. And this is the one and only Larry Elder, welcome to the show.
Whenever I'm told I'm the one and only, that means old. I've been doing this almost 40 years, Zuby.
That's good, man.
And thank you for not calling me the black face of white supremacy, which is what I was called by an LA Times columnist whose initials are Erica D. Smith. Oops. It was in a headline. The column said, Larry Elder is the black face of white supremacy. Subheadline, Zuby, you've been warned. Ironically, the LA Times is in serious financial trouble, as are a lot of major newspapers, and they had let go about 150 people. And one of the persons who was let go was another columnist with the LA Times named Gene Guerrero, who referred to my views as white supremacist. Mm. The LA Times said they were laying off people based upon who had the most, the ones who had the most seniority would be retained, the ones who had the least seniority would be let go. Interestingly, however, the one they call me the black face of white supremacy had less seniority than the one who called me a white supremacist, but the white supremacist got let go first. She is a Latina, and apparently I think they feared that the black woman, Erica D. Smith, was going to play the race card and sue, so they kept her. So DEI saved her job, I think.
Now more than ever, the ability to see through the chaos of traditional news media is an absolute necessity. Biased narratives and selective reporting obstruct the informed critical thinking that we should all be striving for. That's why I'm excited to introduce you to today's sponsor, Ground News. Ground News compiles stories from all across the political spectrum, globally and locally, giving you every angle so you get the full picture you need to stay ahead of rampant media bias. Every story comes with a quick visual breakdown of the number of articles covering it and the political bias, ownership, and headlines of the sources reporting. One of my favorite features is their blind spot feed, where you can see stories that are disproportionately covered by one side of the political spectrum or the other. Ground News does a great job at helping me see behind the curtain of mainstream media. I highly recommend you give Ground News a try. My listeners can get 40% off their Vantage subscription, which gives you unlimited access to all of their incredible features. Go to ground.news/Zuby or click the link in the description to subscribe for just $5 a month. Check out Ground News today and stay informed. Well, I mean, coming across these headlines, being from the UK, I was feeling rather intimidated about this conversation. You know, I didn't know if you were going to come in wearing the white hood or what. But it seems like they weren't quite telling the truth on that.
It's in the cleaners. It's getting clean. Yeah. it had spots on it. I didn't want to bring down your show.
Yeah.
No, it's insane. I mean, right now, there is a Senate race in California. Mm. And the Republican candidate is a guy named Steve Garvey. I don't know if you know American baseball. He was a major, major baseball player for the Dodgers and for the San Diego Padres, mm-hmm. two big cities in L.A. So he has some base and high name recognition. This is in the 70s, though. The leading candidate is Adam Schiff, who's raised like $20, $30 million. Second candidate is named Katie Porter. She's raised about $20 million.
And those are both Democrats.
Both Democrats. And Steve Garvey, Republicans, raised $600,000. Mm-hmm. So he's being pounded with TV ads. And with only $600K, you can't respond. And so the ads have said, I saw one this morning before I came over, this picture of Steve Garvey, picture of Adam Schiff. I couldn't tell who put the commercial up at first. And then it said, Steve Garvey, he voted for Donald Trump twice.
Oh, my gosh.
Not just once, but twice. That's the argument. And when I ran for governor, every ad, and there were a bunch of ads, showed a picture of Larry Elder and Donald Trump. At the time, I had taken one picture with Trump in my life. Both of us had our thumbs up. And Trump reached out to support me, and I said, look, I wanted this to be California-centric. What they're going to do is turn this into a referendum on Republicans, because Republican is a four-letter word in California, so I don't need anybody outside the state reaching out and endorsing me. So Trump didn't. Mm-hmm. But you'd get the impression that he did. And the ads over and over and over again said, stop the Republican takeover. Mm-hmm. They didn't say Gavin Newsom is doing a great job on crime, which since 2019 is up in many cities. Doing a great job on homelessness. California has probably about half the homeless population in the country. Gavin Newsom is doing a great job on retaining people in California. In the last 3 years, we've lost a net 1 million people. Gavin Newsom is doing a great job on schools. Our schools are rated near the bottom. Cost of living out of control. The average price of a home in California is twice that of the national average. Mm. They didn't say any of that. They just said, stop the Republican takeover. Joe Biden flew out and said, Larry Elder is the closest thing to a Donald Trump clone as I've ever seen. I didn't know whether I should be flattered or insulted. Kamala Harris cut a commercial for him. Elizabeth Warren did. Bernie Sanders did. They all said the same thing. Stop Republican takeover. Because, as I said, the Republicans have such a horrible reputation in California. We are outnumbered in terms of Republicans versus non-Republicans 3-1. And there hasn't been a Republican who's won statewide in California in almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. That's all they did. In my book, As Goes California, Zuby, I talk about what happened when the race was over. By the way, I got in with just 8 weeks left. I raised $27 million in 8 weeks, more than all the other 45 replacement candidates combined. Mm-hmm. California has 58 counties. I carried 57 to 58. The person that the Republicans wanted is a two-term mayor of San Diego named Kevin Faulkner. Kevin McCarthy told all the 12 or so House Republican members in California to endorse Faulkner. Nobody endorsed me. I carried San Diego County by 30 points. Mm-hmm. So it was obvious that the grassroots wanted me, but I got not a dime from the state GOP nor from the national GOP. So I lost the race by about 20 points. There's some shenanigans, but I've never said that it was stolen, mm-hmm. but I lost by 20 points. So the race is over. I go to a restaurant on the west side of L.A. L.A. is liberal. West side is even more liberal than the rest of L.A. To meet a buddy of mine for dinner. He's late. So I'm sitting there, and the table over here with two ladies, and I think they feel sorry for me sitting by myself. They start talking to me. Mm-hmm. And it turns out they were both Jewish, 85 years old. They'd known each other since the second grade. One of them was celebrating her 85th birthday. Mm-hmm. And about 20 minutes into the conversation, one of them said, wait a minute. I know you. You're that guy that ran the recall. You're that Larry Elder. And they smiled and said, well, guess who we voted for? I said, we didn't vote for me. They said, how do you know that? I said, well, let's see. You're both Jewish. One of you said that you are a human rights activist. We're in the west side of L.A. You didn't vote for me. Mm-hmm. And they admitted they didn't. Mm-hmm. I said, well, tell me something. How do you feel about the crime? And they both knew people who had been mugged. How do you feel about the quality of our schools here in Los Angeles? And they both admitted they would never put their kid in a LAUSD school to save their lives. Their kids were in private schools. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the way Gavin Newsom shut down the state in a more severe way than anybody else did? So now about a third of all restaurants in California are now gone forever. Yeah. And these are small restaurants owned by the black and brown mom and pop people that people on the left purport to care about. And they both told me they knew people who lost their businesses. How do you feel about the way people are leaving California? And they both said that they'd lost very good friends who could no longer take it here because of the taxes, mm-hmm. And they couldn't afford to buy a house. I said, so here we are completing each other's sentences, but you didn't vote for me.
Yeah.
And I said, have you ever had a conversation with a conservative Republican before? And they said, no.
He's an 85-year-old
woman. Yeah. And I said, and one of them said, what are you drinking? I said, double vodka, splash of cranberry and orange juice. She said, I'll get that for you. What are you eating? I said, well, I was going to have steak, but I think I'm going to upgrade it to lobster. So they bought my drinks. They bought my meal. We had a great time. They had never spoken to a conservative Republican before.
Wow.
Also in the book, later on in the book, I have some back issues, which is why I take something called Relief Factor. That's not a plug. And my friend gives me the name of a masseuse, a massage therapist. He said might be able to improve something. So I go, look at the address. I'm thinking it's going to be in an office building somewhere, and it's a residential street. I turn down. It's a house. So I knock on the door. Lady opens the door. I get hit in the face with a big plume of marijuana. Mm-hmm. Not that I would know what that would smell like, of course.
No idea.
And she's got tattoos everywhere, piercings everywhere but her eyeballs. And she starts working on me, and she's playing Motown music. I know you're a rapper, but my favorite genre is Motown.
Yeah.
And they played a song, My Girl, one of my favorite songs. And I said, that's My Girl. When I got married years ago, I played it at my wedding. It was written by Smokey Robinson. He wrote it for David Ruffin, who at the time was the lead singer of The Temptations. David Ruffin, unfortunately, died from a drug overdose. Another song came on. That's Marvin Gaye. Marvin Gaye wrote this one called What's Going On. Berry Gordy, the then owner of Motown, didn't want him to record it because he wanted to control all the composition. Marvin Gaye did it anyway and became the biggest hit Motown ever had at the time. So about half hour into the conversation, into the session, she says, I know who you are. I know who you were when you called. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to say anything. Had I known you were this funny and this personable, I would have voted for you. Mm. I said, do you know any Republicans? She said, no. I said, not a one? She said, no. Luby, Zoe, what is this?
Yeah.
What is this? Talk about people being in their silos.
Yeah.
What is that?
Wow. I often, you know, when you were describing that, I often wonder if with those situations, I think it's more likely that they are not aware that they've ever had a conversation with a conservative or a Republican. I don't believe you can reach 85 years old and live in a state with as many people as California and you've never actually spoken to a conservative. I have an echo of this story because when I was in London for 2 years, I lived with I had two female flatmates that I lived with, and we never talked about politics or social stuff, cultural stuff on any deep level. But I remember many years after living with these girls when I'd become a full-time musician and I was just posting my stuff on social media and whatnot. Many years later, one of my former flatmates saw one of my tweets, which I can't remember what tweet it was, but it must have been something that made it obvious that I was more conservative leaning. Mm-hmm. And we had this sort of back and forth on it. And at some point, she said something she'd never had a conversation with a conservative person before. And I was like, we lived in the same apartment for 2 years. We just didn't. Yeah, I was like, we just didn't have those conversations because a lot of people, they conjure up an idea and a fabrication and a caricature of what they think conservative or Republican means. So I find that a lot of people in very liberal or progressive areas, they get their idea of conservatism from their progressive friends and progressive media rather than from actual conservatives. So I think that's part of several reasons why it's even been shown in numerous polls that, mm-hmm, generally speaking, conservatives understand liberals better than liberals understand conservatives. And you'll be hard pressed to find a conservative person who's like, oh, I've never had a conversation with a liberal before, because it's just like, how is that even possible? Like, did you go to school? Did you go to university? Mm-hmm. Do you just exist in the world and the workplace? How can you not have ever met someone with those viewpoints? So I think it's more the fact that people are not even aware. And maybe because conservatives maybe in the state are more quiet about their views, they don't wear it on their sleeve for obvious reasons mm-hmm, as pertains to tolerance or lack thereof. And so I think you have all these people interacting and integrating, but oftentimes that's not put front and center. And when it is, that's when they think, oh, the boogeyman is coming out.
But I also think it's the dominance of the left in media, in academia, in big tech, in Hollywood. I just saw a poll that said only 3% of journalists describe themselves as Republicans, mm-hmm, 3%. And at Harvard, all the controversy with Claudine Gay, it turns out only about 3% of Harvard professors call themselves somewhat conservative or conservative.
Yes.
So the ones who call themselves conservative is probably 2% or maybe 1%. Mm-hmm. So they're just not hearing the ideas. You look at Hollywood, dominated of the contributions given to parties by the top executive in Hollywood, 90% of them go to Democrats or Democrat causes. Same thing with the Ivy League. I went to an Ivy League school. 90% of the contributions by professors go to the Democrats or Democrat causes. Mm-hmm. So these kids are having a one-sided view of almost anything. And as a result, when you sit there and talk to somebody who has some different points of view, no matter how well thought out and commonsensical they are, often they're surprised because they just haven't heard them.
Who's at fault there?
Well, I think that a lot of people don't go into those conservatives don't go into these areas because they feel they're going to be screwed. I mean, in order to get tenure, if you're in a university, you have to be voted on by the other professors. And I know a lot of instances of professors who've gotten blackballed or refused tenure because of their views. There's a guy named John Lott. John Lott is a economist, does a lot of work on guns, and he wrote a book called More Guns, Less Crime. At the time, he didn't even own a gun, and he wasn't even that conservative. He just found out nobody ever done a study on the relationship or lack of relationship between gun ownership and crime. Mm-hmm. And it turned out, according to John, and I'm kind of summarizing complex research, but it turns out, according to John, counties with the greatest per capita gun ownership had less crime. And so he wrote a book called More Guns, Less Crime. One of the big donors at the time, he was teaching at University of Chicago, major university. One of their big donors approached the dean and said, I'm not going to give you any more money unless you get rid of this guy. Mm. And they did. And so John goes somewhere else to another university that didn't know this controversy. And then he's there for a little while. And then it found out who he is. And another prominent donor approached the dean and basically put pressure on him to get rid of John. So John never became a tenured professor, even though he's got great credentials. And his scholarship, in my opinion, has withstood the test of time. I mean, you write something that controversial, you're going to have a whole bunch of people picking at it and picking over it. There were some minor errors in his research. He corrected them. But for the most part, I think his research has held up. Mm-hmm. Fox News often uses him to quote the stuff on guns. So he ended up starting a nonprofit called the Crime Prevention Research Group because he couldn't get a job as a tenured professor. Yeah. And he's not the only one to whom I've heard stories like that. So I think if I'm somebody who's got some ambition and I have a bunch of alternatives to do this, that, and the other, why would I go into academia? Why would I go into journalism? Why would I go into any of these fields where the powers that be are going to decide my fate? I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go into some other place where I can have better control over my life.
Yeah.
Our podcast today is sponsored by the Exit and Build Land Summit. I've been speaking out about the Great Reset for several years, and many people are especially concerned about so-called smart cities being pushed by the World Economic Forum. They're designed to watch everything you do, harvest your data, and regulate every part of your life. I'm an urban dweller myself, but I'm not interested in going through another lockdown, eating bugs, or living in a pod. No thanks. That's why friend of the show John Bush created the Exit and Build Land Summit back in 2021. It's helped tens of thousands of people around the world to exit cities and suburbs and build a better, freer life in the country. It's one of the largest gatherings of top homesteaders, permaculturists, and community builders in America. This year's summit will feature J.P. Sears, Joel Salatin, David Holmgren, and dozens of other world-class speakers. If you want to learn how to move to the country, raise healthy food and animals on a homestead, or create or join an intentional community, then you should check it out. The event is live May 17th to 19th, so sign up with a free pass, a virtual pass, or attend in person in Bastrop, Texas for an unforgettable experience. Go to exitandbuildlandsummit.com to sign up today. That's exitandbuildlandsummit.com.
How and why do you think that has changed over time, over the decades? Because I'm not American, let alone Californian. First time I ever even came to this state.
You say that with pride. Let alone a Californian. Zuby sniffs. Let alone a Californian.
Yeah, I love the USA. Yeah. California is not one of my top states, but I do come here a lot. I know a lot of good people here, yeah. And I have friends here, and it is one of the most beautiful parts of the world.
I think it's the most beautiful state in America. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised here. The politics are awful. I mean,
how has it changed since you were in your youth in terms of the politics? Well, because I know that this used to be a Republican state, no?
It sure did. Okay. I mean, Orange County used to be the most reliably Republican county in the country. Mm-hmm. Richard Nixon was a senator here. Ronald Reagan was a two-term governor here. We had a governor named Pete Wilson, mm-hmm. who also served two terms.
Even Arnold?
Arnold. But and that's interesting you mentioned that. Arnold became governor in a recall election, and that's what I ran in a recall election in 2021. Arnold's was 2003. Mm. And since then, there are now 5% more registered Democrats. There are 33% fewer registered Republicans, and there are 50% more registered independents. And even the New York Times said independents in California vote Republican. So the state has just gotten more and more left-wing since I've been a kid.
Why?
A lot of Republicans have left. I think kids are being taught that Republicans are bad. I think kids are being taught that capitalism is bad. Kids are being taught that if you're wealthy, you did something to screw people. It wasn't that you worked hard. I think little by little, we've indoctrinated young people into having negative attitudes towards capitalism, towards God, towards religion. And as a result, we are now manufacturing kids that are more and more left-wing.
Is that unique to California, though?
I think it's worse in California. California is one of the most left-wing states. Massachusetts is up there, too. But I think it's happening all over the country.
Yeah.
We are just, you know, look at the universities. I saw a study about the professors at universities, big, small, east, west, north, south, public, private. Overwhelmingly, the professors are left-wing.
Yeah.
And if you assume that teachers have some sort of influence on how you think and see the world, then we are creating more and more left-wing people.
Hmm. It's interesting because I wonder what the things are that sort of separate California from other states or even other places in the world. Because if you look at academia around the entire world, or you look at in the entertainment industry, or you look at mainstream media, it always has a liberal bias. These are things that are based in big cities, whether it's LA, New York, London, Paris, Berlin, all of these places, big cities in general, no matter where you go in the world, they tend to lean more liberal than more rural areas and smaller towns and cities. That's just kind of a global phenomenon. I'm sure somebody has explored why that is. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what it is uniquely about California, given it wasn't always that way. I just wonder what it is that changed over the course of those few decades that it has switched so reliably to the point where people who are trying to run as Republicans essentially feel like they don't really stand a chance, and people just dogmatically vote in one way and don't even want to give the other side a chance.
Yeah. I think another factor in California is it's the demographics have changed pretty dramatically. At one time, I think when I was a kid, 80% of the state was white. The rest of it was so-called people of color. Mm-hmm. Now, roughly 40%, 45% of the state is Hispanic. Mm-hmm. About 40% is white. 9.5% or so Asian, only about 6.5% is Black. And so the racial demographics of California have changed dramatically, and people who are on the of color typically vote Democrat.
Why do you think that is?
They've been taught that race and racism remain major problems in America. They've been taught that social justice is more important than crime, than schools, than jobs, and they're buying into it.
What do you think is going on there? Because it seems like there's some type of cognitive dissonance that goes on in these major cities where simultaneously you'll have people complaining about taxes, complaining about crime, perhaps even being victims of it themselves, complaining about homelessness, drug abuse, you know, rampant people just strewn around the streets, complaining about, I don't know, shoplifting and car break-ins, complaining about the schools and the lack of achievement, lack of reading standards. All of these things, yet they don't seem to draw a connection in their mind between their voting patterns and the policies and the results on the ground. And this seems to have been going on for many, many years. And as someone who considers himself quite logical and rational, I don't understand how that attitude can be so pervasive.
It's the $64,000 question, Zubin. If I could answer that, you'd be talking to me from Sacramento in the governor's mansion. I think it's kind of like, again, indoctrination. I know I use that word a lot, but I think Black people in particular have been taught Republicans are bad. Republicans are racist. Republicans only care about the wealthy people. Democrats are the party of social justice, the party that wears the white hat when it comes to equity. And that's what I think they've been told. I think it's changing to some extent because Donald Trump got around 8% of the Black vote in 2016.
I love the fact
he got 12% in 2020.
Yeah,
20% of Black men voted for him. And now it looks like almost 40% of blacks are considering voting Republican in 2024. So I think it's finally changing. Look, if you look at the quality of schools,
yes.
85% of black eighth graders nationwide can neither read nor do math at grade level. 85%. These are 13-year-old black kids. And in places like Baltimore, there are 13 public high schools in Baltimore, all located in the inner city, where 0% of kids can do math at grade level.
Zero.
Chicago, there are 53 government schools. That's a term I prefer rather than public schools, sure. Government schools. 53 government schools in Chicago, 0% of the kids can do math at grade level. Yet the Democratic Party opposes school choice, where the money follows the child rather than the other way around, so that the parents can shop around for a better school. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the Democrats themselves have always had their own kids in elite schools. Barack Obama did. Elizabeth Warren did. Mm-hmm. Gavin Newsom did. Joe Biden did. They all had their kids in private schools. Yet they oppose school choice for people living in the inner city. Mm-hmm. And if you look at polls of black and brown people living in the inner city, they want school choice, yet they still vote Democrat. You tell me why. I can't think of anything more important than making sure that your kid gets a good education.
Yeah.
And yet they're still pulling the lever for the same party that denies you the right to have mm-hmm. school choice, even though that's what you want.
From an external perspective and someone who doesn't really have a dog in this fight, I mean, I can't vote anyway. I'm not Democrat. I'm not Republican. As an outside observer and as a creative and entrepreneurial person, I think a lot of it is branding. I think it really comes down to branding and emotive messaging and how people feel and what their assumptions are about each party. And for better or for worse, it depends on which angle someone looks at it as it from. It seems like the left or the Democrats have been able to brand the American right or the Republicans as racist, misogynistic, fascistic, don't care about anyone but white people, party of big business, don't care about social justice. I mean, when you look at the actual numbers and policies, all of this is bunk to me, but the branding has been so strong, and the branding of the Democrats is, hey, if you're a woman, if you're a minority, if you're a young person, if you're LGBTQ, if you're any of these categories, we're the ones for you. We're the ones who care about you. We're the ones. It's this sort of emotive messaging, which even though on an idea to idea perspective, a lot of these ideas and policies are lacking and the results are not good, but they make people feel good. They move people's hearts and emotions in a way where they go, oh, okay, that's the guy or gal I want to vote for. And simultaneously, yeah, they brand the Republicans or the conservatives as mean or uncaring or somehow hateful. And I think it's garbage, but that really seems to be what's at play. Like it's kind of a branding problem. I think that the Republican conservative side needs to get better at the branding part. And I know people don't like to think that way because they just want to win on ideas and they want to win on policies. But I just think that there's a branding problem. And there's something, I don't know exactly what it is that needs to be changed in the messaging, but something needs to be changed there because
but keep in mind, those narratives, the messengers are left wing. Mm. I gave a lot of interviews when I was running for governor, and I said many of the same you're saying right now.
Yeah.
And I pick up the newspaper, and it's a completely different human being they were talking to. I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
There was a poll I saw not long ago. 61% of Democrats believe Republicans are racist / bigoted / sexist.
Wow.
Only 30% of Republicans feel the same way about Democrats. Mm-hmm. 83% of black Democrats believe that Donald Trump is a racist.
Yes.
This is a guy who supports school choice. He gave us the most secure border than we've had probably in American history. The reason that's important is because there was a study done by the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and it found that because of the presence of illegal alien labor, there are 1 million fewer black people working mm-hmm. than would otherwise be the case, and that illegal alien labor puts downward pressure to the tune of $2,000 per year on the salaries of people living in the inner city. Mm-hmm. So closing the borders disproportionately benefits black people. This is a guy who expanded what are called opportunity zones. These are distressed areas in the inner city, lowering taxes, lowering regulations in order to spark economic activity. Best economy ever for black people. He put funding for historically black colleges on a permanent basis for 10 years. No one ever done that before. Mm-hmm. This may sound like just symbolic, but the first black heavyweight champion is a guy named Jack Johnson. He was heavyweight champion from 1905 to 1915, if I'm not mistaken. And he was arrested and tried and thrown in jail for something called violating the Mann Act, M-A-N-N. Essentially, he had a white girlfriend and transported her across state lines, which was illegal. Mm-hmm. Thrown in jail for that. A left-wing documentarian named Ken Burns and the actor Sylvester Stallone of Rocky approached George W. Bush to have them pardon Jack Johnson. He's now, of course, dead.
Yeah.
And W. didn't do it. They approached Obama. Obama didn't do it. Mm-hmm. Trump did. Mm-hmm. Trump also pardoned a woman named Alice Johnson, who got a very long but nonviolent drug sentence for, I think it was almost 20 years, mm-hmm. and he commuted her sentence. No one else had done that before. So you look at all the things that Donald Trump did that benefited black people, and if this dude is a racist, he needs to go back to racism school.
Yeah.
Yet, when I tell people this, it doesn't seem to matter.
It's the feelings. It's the
emotive.
I'll
give you another example. I have a very good friend. His name is Will. That is his real name. Mm-hmm. And I've known him for over 40 years. I was very close with my late brother, Kirk. But when I got married years ago, I chose Will over my brother to be the best man at my wedding. That's how close we were. Mm-hmm. And Will has a son with special needs. His son is named Jesse. Jesse's middle name is my first name. My name is Lawrence with a U. His middle name is Lawrence with a U. That's how close we were. He is convinced that Donald Trump mocked a disabled reporter.
Oh, gosh.
You know the story.
I know this one.
The guy who he allegedly mocked is a reporter at the time with the New York Times. His name was Serge Kovaleski. And Serge Kovaleski has some sort of ailment, which gives him an atrophied arm, kind of like this.
Yes.
But he doesn't shake like this. And the reason he came up in the news is because Donald Trump, shortly after he got elected, was talking about the fact that he said there were several Muslims who were cheering the fall of the towers on 9/11. Well, because Trump is Trump, every word he says, they fact check it, and no one could find any evidence that this happened. So Trump produced an article written by this guy where he said he observed people cheering the fall of the walls, of the Twin Towers. So reporters approached the reporter and asked him about the story. And he began to retreat from the story. I'm not quite sure I saw that many. I'm not sure they were Muslim. I'm not sure. So Donald Trump is at one of his rallies. I mean, the man's a stand-up comic.
Yes.
And he said, and they approached him. He went, I don't know. I don't remember.
Yep. I remember this.
And so the story was Donald Trump is mocking a disabled reporter. By the way, interesting, Kovaleski never even said he mocked me. Mm-hmm. Other people said it. And I sent my friend a 3-page letter linking a website called Catholics 4, the number 4, Trump is still up, showing Trump using the same gesture to mock himself, to mock an able-bodied general. Donald Trump uses that gesture, and he wasn't mocking his disability. He was mocking his retreat from the story.
Yes.
3-page letter with that link. My friend, by the way, is brilliant. Perfect score on his SAT, close to a perfect score on his LSAT. That's how bright he is. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter. And I said, Will, what makes you think I would vote for somebody if he mocked a disabled person? What do you think of me? Mm. It didn't matter, Zuby. And I learned something. Once you hate Donald Trump, no evidence is going to make you unhate him.
Yes.
Another example. Another reason Donald Trump is perceived to be a racist because he allegedly said there were good Nazis and bad Nazis both sides in Charlottesville. He did no such thing. He was talking about the issue of whether there should be a Confederate monument in the public square.
Yes. I managed to change my mom's mind on this one by showing her the longer clip because she had fallen for it.
Well, Jake Tapper, one of the lead guys on CNN,
yeah.
2 years after the fact, said, you know what? I went back and looked at the tape.
Yep.
And Donald Trump was saying there are good people and bad people on both sides of the issue about whether there should be a Confederate monument in the public square. Mm-hmm. In fact, he even said, and I'm not talking about mm-hmm. the white nationalists and neo-Nazis because they should be condemned totally.
Yes.
Michael Smirkanish is a weekend host on CNN. 2 years later, somebody calls his radio show and says, you know, you got that wrong. And Smirkanish admitted, I went back, I looked at the tape, and you're right. After Tapper said this, Joe Biden goes on CNN 2 or 3 days later
okay. And
says it again. And Zuby, nobody said, well, you know, Jake Tapper, my colleague down the hall, he just now clarified it. They didn't say a word.
No.
And Biden still says it. He gave a speech before the United Nations and said it again, which is, this is why I decided to run for office. I wasn't going to run until, you know, who said there's good people and bad people on both sides. So I decided to get into the race. If Donald Trump is that bad, do you have to make stuff up?
Yep. It's crazy. I've come across this a lot because these narratives are not just pervasive in the USA. They're pervasive globally. I travel internationally all the time and I have conversations with people publicly and privately about all sorts of things. And I bet you that if you were to survey most people in the UK or even in, I don't know, Germany or France or whatever, and ask them about those specific things, did Donald Trump say X? Did he do Y? Then they would be like, oh, yeah, he said that. I remember seeing that clip on TV. And those clips, they're not just on the US media. They're also in the UK. And they cut off the tape at the same place where it sounds like he's just said this. And just before he says, and I'm not talking about white nationalists and white supremacists, they should be condemned totally, the tape just stops. And so this is what happens in somebody's brain, because they'll remember, wait, no, I saw and I heard that. And they did. They just saw a clip. And so what they're recalling is accurate. But it's just like, but to come as an outsider and explain them and say, oh, no, he didn't say that. And they're like, no, he did say that. I heard it. And then it's like, oh, no, you have to listen to an extra 20 seconds. And it's, and you have, people have to be led there. And I think that that's, there's something that you were saying earlier, which is, coming back to answer one of my own questions about the branding and the messaging coming more from the conservative or right side of the political aisle, is I think what's often missed, and I had this conversation with Vivek Ramaswamy last year because I did his podcast, and I was saying that I think that where Republicans sometimes mess up on messaging, I have quite a few criticisms, but I think one of them is that the dots are not explicitly connected. So say you want to secure the border. It's just build the wall, secure the border. We need to get rid of the illegals. We need to cut that down. If you stop there, what you're doing is you're creating a massive opening for disingenuous people who are in opposition to you say, oh, you're racist. You hate brown people. You're this, you're that. If the dots were connected and people actually explained, as you did, hey, by securing the border, look, this illegal immigration, this is who it's disproportionately impacting. It's not people living in wealthy suburbs, whatever. It's disproportionately affecting these people. These are the impacts on crime and the safety of your communities and so on. Therefore, we need to secure the border to keep you people safe. I think those dots need to be connected more. If it's something as simple as, cutting taxes, we want to reduce taxes or we want to cut regulation. Again, you create an opening for people to say, oh, you hate poor people. You want people to suffer. You want those single mothers and people in inner city. You just want them to suffer by cutting the taxation. Whereas if it were explained, okay, look, by cutting taxation, it will have all of these different positive effects. And I find that the second part of the messaging is often missed, because I think when you're already talking to, let's say, a Republican or conservative audience, those dots are already connected in their head. So it's obvious why securing the border is important. It's obvious why cutting taxes is good for entrepreneurship and opportunity and so on. But for someone who's like these people you said before, who have, they've never even heard conservative ideas before, I think those dots are not connected to their head. So if you just say, hey, I want to cut taxes, or say you want to do, you want to remove a certain government program, or you want to do this or do that, their brains think, oh, well, in my head, Republicans are evil and they want people to suffer. So by cutting taxes, oh, that validates it. They want people to suffer even more. Oh, by wanting to secure the border, oh, that validates my idea that they are racist and they are xenophobic and so on. So I think that simple extra step of messaging would actually go a long way. And I find that when I do listen to Republican politicians or even commentators, they often don't do that part of the messaging, maybe because they just don't think it's needed, or they think that it's self-evident. And I don't necessarily think it is for everybody.
Well, I also think it's important, and I try to do this on my radio show, point out that the things that Donald Trump said about illegal immigration have been said by Democrats for decades.
For sure.
Harry Reid, the former leader of the Senate, once even used the term illegal alien to describe how ridiculous he said it was to allow people to come to the country, have children, and have those children automatically be citizens. Barack Obama, Senator Barack Obama, 2005, I think it was, also talked about unbridled immigration. We need to do something about it. Chuck Schumer said something very similar. And I think we need to remind people that these ideas of Donald Trump were said by Democrats decades before Donald Trump ever even emerged on the scene. January 6th, another example. The part that the Democrats focus on is when Donald Trump said, I want you to go to the Capitol and fight like hell. Mm. That's just political rhetoric. People have been saying fight like hell for a long time. Harry Truman was used that term a lot. Give him hell, Harry, one of his nicknames. And he says, I don't give him hell, I give him the truth, and they think it's hell. So it's just standard political rhetoric. And they ignore the fact that Donald Trump said, I want you to peacefully and patriotically go and make your voices heard. That's what he also said, but they ignore that part of it. It's just incredibly unfair. And this business about election denying, for the 4 years that Donald Trump was in office, Hillary referred to him as illegitimate,
yes,
and said the election was stolen. The then DHS Secretary Jay Johnson under Obama testified under oath that while the Russians tried to change vote tallies in 2016, they tried to manipulate the machines, they failed to change a single vote tally. Yet a poll found that 66% of Democrats believe the Russians, quote, changed vote tallies, close quote, in 2016 to elect Donald Trump. No evidence of it whatsoever. Jimmy Carter, the former president, said, I believe the Russians put Donald Trump there. This is a former president, like former President Donald Trump, essentially saying the election was stolen. Nobody called him an election denier. And this business about what Donald Trump tried to do with Vice President Cheney to get him to refuse to certify certain states in January 2021, it was done by Democrats in 2000 when Al Gore lost to George W. Bush. The Democrats, 12 of them, most of them black, argued that the VP, then Al Gore, had the opportunity to refuse to certify Florida, claiming that the Florida vote was manipulated. Mm-hmm. 4 years later, W gets reelected. He won Ohio. 30 Democrats, including Barbara Boxer, tried to prevent the vice president from decertifying Ohio, claiming that the Diebold voting machine had been manipulated. And in 2016, the Democrats challenged more states, 9, than Donald Trump did in 2020. When he challenged 6, they all made the same argument that the VP had more than ceremonial powers. He could send the election back to various states if they thought there were shenanigans going on. All I'm saying is the Democrats did every single thing Donald Trump did. And what the response always is, well, Democrats did not storm the Capitol on January 6th. Mm-hmm. Well, that's because Hillary wasn't in office.
Deadly insurrection.
Had she been in office and the shoe was on the other foot, what makes you think her supporters would have been any more peaceful? Mm-hmm. When Donald Trump got elected in January and in November of 2016, there were protests, including violent protests, in 40 cities. A police car was set on fire. And when Donald Trump was inaugurated January of 2017, I think it was 200 people were arrested for staging violent protests. So the idea that somehow, some way, Hillary supporters would have been more graceful had the shoe been on the other foot, what's the evidence of that? Mm-hmm. And people then say, well, Hillary didn't file lawsuits to overturn the election. Yes, she did. She joined a lawsuit that was filed by Jill Stein, the independent candidate who tried to overturn Wisconsin, and Hillary filed a separate motion to have the recount done by hand. So the idea that because Republicans are protesting elections, they are now election deniers and threatening the foundation of our republic when Democrats have done it for years, it's just BS. Yeah. And it's incredibly unfair. And mm-hmm. again, because the media is so biased, all the things I just now said to you, you're not going to pick up the newspaper and read them. All you're going to find out is Donald Trump is once again denying the election when Hillary did the same thing and nobody called her anything.
Yeah. Do you ever think that too much stock is put into politics in this country, especially when it comes to party politics, the whole left versus right, blue versus red, constant back and forth ping pong?
You know, the actual effect on your life and my life, any given day, is going to be determined more by our jobs, more by crime, mm-hmm. more by the quality of our schools. That's really the kind of thing that affects you on a personal level, far more so than whoever gets elected president. Mm-hmm. So it is often perceived to me as almost a transference of anger and bitterness without any real consequence on your own life. I mean, yes. People that hate Donald Trump, how was your life hurt when Donald Trump was president? Gas prices were low, inflation was low, interest rates were low. How were things bad for you? Mm-hmm. But you hate this guy all out of proportion to what impact he had on your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think that the greatest problems, not just in this country, I think the same in mine, I don't think it's primarily political. I think it's social, cultural, familial, community-based. And I think that the obsession, especially over top-level or federal-level politics, more so than local, I think oftentimes it's a distraction and an outsourcing of responsibility. Mm-hmm. Because if I think of, okay, what are the problems plaguing the USA from my perspective? It's not about who's in the White House or which whatever the administration is, those problems are still there and they're generally getting worse. I'm talking about familial disintegration and absent fathers. I'm talking about rising obesity and, for the first time in history, dropping life expectancy. I'm talking about 100,000 plus Americans per year dying of drug overdoses, homelessness, the school problem. I mean, schools where kids can't even read, do math, and so on. Like, to me, these are, yeah, some of them are connected to politics, and I'm sure there are policies that could potentially improve these things. But when I think about individuals and families and what is happening in those dynamic, all of these issues are downstream of that. It seems like, not to even oversimplify a multivariate problem, but I often wonder, hey, if families came together and stayed together,
right,
and kids were raised by their mother and their father, regardless of color, creed, ethnicity, whatever, poor, rich, and that unit was strong, and then maybe on top of it, the schools were at least decent, how many of these problems would you have and how severe would they be? And things would be so, so, so much better. And I think that that conversation is largely avoided. I mean, every time, again, it's weird to me from as an outsider, you know, when these, so what from America makes the news globally? It's the bad stuff. You know, it's a mad, there was another school shooting. There was someone went to a mall and went crazy with a rifle or a handgun or whatever the case may be. And the conversation is always about the gun. It's always about the tool. In the UK, the same thing happens with stabbing, by the way. They start having conversations about how long can a knife be, and should you need more ID to buy it? I'm like, guys, we all have knives. Everyone has knives in their kitchens. The problem is not that knives exist, but they distract from the core issue because they don't want to talk about, oh, the vast majority of young men doing these things do not grow up with fathers or even father figures in their lives. And they're in these communities and they've been through these things. And sometimes they were known to the police and perhaps they're on a certain type of drug, which is causing them to have certain things. And all that conversation is just avoided. And it immediately just comes back to the beating sticks back and forth of, should AR-15s be banned? How many bullets should you be allowed in a magazine? Should there be, it just comes to the tool. And to me, it's just so dumb. And it happens over, it's been happening my whole life. My entire life, when I see these stories, I'm like, it's the same the same thing happens,
right.
Same conversation, no serious conversation about, okay, what's actually going on? Okay, let's think about this. Primarily, this is young men between 15 and 25 who are over 90% of these perpetrators. Vast majority of them they're coming from a certain background, mm-hmm. certain things lacking. Where's that conversation? I know it's not something you can click your fingers and fix, but it just shocks and disheartens me that conversation is barely even happening.
I just did the Charlemagne the God podcast. I don't know if you saw that.
Breakfast Club.
Yeah. He's the one to whom Joe Biden said, you ain't really black unless you want know if you want to vote for me or vote for Trump. I told him the number one social problem in America is what I call the epidemic of fatherlessness.
Yes.
70% of black kids are raised today without a father in the home, married to the mother, up from 25% back in 1965. Now 25% of white kids into the world without a father in the home, married to the mother, 40% of all American kids do. And the numbers are clear. If you were raised without a father, you're 5 times more likely to be poor and commit crime, 9 times more likely to drop out of school, and 20 times more likely to end up in jail. Even Tupac, the rapper, said that, I know that had I had a father in my life, I would have been more confident, I would have been more disciplined. 60% of all the robberies, the shootings, and the homicides in America are committed by black people, often against other black people. The number one cause of preventable death for a white teenager 19 and under is accidents like car accidents or drownings or drug overdoses. The number one cause of preventable death for a black teenager male 19 and under is homicide, almost always at the hands of another black male. A black male 13 to 43 is 13 times more likely to be murdered than a white male, same demo. Now, unless we're prepared to say black people are just genetically inclined to commit more crime, if it isn't the absence of fathers in the home, please tell me what it is, I told him. And he had no response to that. Mm.
But didn't he say white supremacy or something crazy like
he
that?
He did. Yeah. He suggested that. And I said, here's the problem, racism and poverty.
White supremacy.
Here's the problem with that. In 1940, 87% of blacks lived below poverty. Mm. This is before the Civil Rights Act of 64, before the KKK was alive and well, Jim Crow was still alive and well. You didn't have this kind of pathology. So if it's poverty and racism, how do you explain that? It's not. It's because of the breakdown of the family. And this conversation is not being had. That's one of the reasons I ran for president. I knew that I wasn't going to get the nomination, but I hoped that I could get the people running to begin talking about this. And to pat myself on the back, Vivek started talking about it. And even Trump did. Hmm. He and I had a meeting in Mar-a-Lago about 2 or 3 months ago, and I mentioned this to him, and he tweeted something about it. So you're right. We straighten that out. Many of the problems that we are complaining about go away, the crime. We have in California, there's been a rash of smash and grabs where a bunch of young people come into a store and steal stuff. Often they're wearing masks, so you can't tell what race they are. But when they're not, and when they get busted, most of them tend to be black. I would be more afraid of my father than I would be of getting caught by the police if I got involved in something like that. These kids are afraid of neither. They don't have a father in the home. Cops are demoralized. They're understaffed. They're pulling back. So they're not afraid of either their father or the police. We should be talking about that more, but we're not.
Yeah. They're uncomfortable conversations. And I think that is why people – I think that's ultimately why people – avoid it. And I think
that's why people call me the black face of white supremacy, too. Seriously. Yeah. And by the way, when I ran for governor, when the run was over, I went back to radio to fulfill my contract. And I invited the woman who referred to me as a black face of white supremacy to come on my show. Let's have a conversation. Yeah. Tell me what it is I've said or done that makes me the black face of white supremacy. Talking about fatherlessness makes me the black face of white supremacy. Talking about how bad urban school makes me that. Talking about how much crime is committed by young black people, often against other young black people, makes me that. Please tell me. She wouldn't come on.
No. I think a lot of people want to feel good and be perceived by their peers as being a quote unquote good person. Mm-hmm. Then they actually want to fix the problem. I think there are far too many people, and especially far too many politicians and people in the media, who care more about feeling good and looking good than doing good. And you see this across so many different issues. I mean, I think is it San Francisco, where if you work out the homeless budget per homeless person, it comes out to something like $150,000 per year per person. And you go to that city, you walk around downtown, you walk around the Tenderloin, and you're just like, what on earth are you doing with this money? I mean, if you gave me $150,000 per homeless person to improve their situation, you give me 1 year, they're not still going to be lying out on the street in their own feces with a needle in their arm. That's not even fathomable. For that type of money, I mean, that's way more money than most people even earn. Mm-hmm. It's more than double what most people earn. So even at a minimum, when it comes to accommodation, like you can't, it's just a... the incentive structures are so broken. And then you learn more about it, and you learn just like a military industrial complex, there's a whole homeless industrial complex, and there are people who are enriching themselves by keeping the problem alive. And it's just bananas, because then people just say, oh, just this is why we need higher taxes. You just need to throw more money at the problem. It's like, guys, I think $150,000 per person is more than adequate. The problem is that people do not actually want, the people in power do not genuinely want these problems fixed. And that's a sad thing to say, but that's the obvious reality of it.
Well, and we know it can be handled if they want to, because remember when the Chinese premier came to the Bay Area?
Oh my gosh.
All of a sudden, the area you're talking about got cleaned up.
I'd actually forgotten about that.
And, you know, I drive to work when I was on radio down a street called Forest Lawn Drive. And there were cars on either side, vans, dirty, filthy. You could tell they'd been there for months. People were living in these vans, block after block after block after block. And I'm driving down that street about 2-3 months ago. They're all gone. Street looks like it used to look.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, some way, they got solved.
Yeah. And other big cities that are far bigger than San Francisco in some cases, they managed to work it out. They managed to sort it out. And I mean, even if you expand the scope outside the USA and you just look at other developed nations, other big cities, it could be, you know, it could be Tokyo, it could be Dubai, it could be Prague, it could be Hamburg, whatever. Like, they don't have this same level of problem. And typically, they're not even using as many resources that are dedicated to the problem. I want to shift gears a little bit, Larry. We've talked about the problem with familial breakdown and father absenteeism. And it's a popular talking point on the conservative side of the spectrum because we recognize just how serious it is. But a question remains, how do you actually incentivize it? How do you reverse this decline in family, what would you call it, family formation and families staying together? How do you bring more fathers back into the picture?
Well, the issue is to talk about the damage done when you bring a child into the world that you're not prepared to feed, clothe, house, and educate. I think that failing to talk about personal responsibility is a big problem. You are basically giving people a pass for making poor decisions. And no matter how badly you are raised, life still comes down to decisions. My father never knew his biological father. He was born in the Jim Crow South in 1915. His mother was illiterate. She didn't work. She had a series of boyfriends she lived off of. My last name, Elder, is the name of some man who lived in my dad's life longer than any of the other men, maybe 4 or 5 years. My dad began using his name. I'm not even sure he formally adopted my father. So my father comes home at the age of 13. This is in Athens, Georgia. And he starts quarreling with his mom's then boyfriend. She sides with the boyfriend and throws my father out of the house, never to return. He had no money in his pocket. He goes down the road, dirt road, cleaned up barns, cleaned up yards, did anything he could to make a buck. Ultimately became a Pullman porter for the trains. They were the largest private employer of blacks in those days. And this little black boy from Athens, Georgia, was able to travel all around the world and came to a place called California. And it was sunny. People seemed less racist. And my dad was shocked. You could walk in the front door of a restaurant, sit down, and get served. He always had boxes of crackers and 10 cans of tuna with him because he never knew if he'd be able to get a meal in the South. So he made a mental note, maybe someday I'll relocate to California. Pearl Harbor, my dad joined Marines. He was in World War II, stationed on the island of Guam. And he gets out, goes back to Chattanooga, Tennessee, where he married my mom to get him a job as a cook because that's what he did in the military. He was the head of cooking for the colored soldiers because the military was segregated in those days. Goes to a restaurant and he's told, we don't hire niggers. Went to another restaurant, we don't hire niggers. Goes to an unemployment office, lady says, you went to the wrong door. My dad goes out in the hall and sees colored only, goes to that door to the very same lady who sent him out. My dad came home to my mom and said, this is BS, I'm going to LA where I was before the war, give me a job as a cook. My dad comes out to LA, walks around, you don't have any references. You don't have any references. My dad said, I need references to make ham and eggs. I will work for free, just give me a written reference. I wouldn't do that. Unemployment office, this time just one door. She had nothing. My dad says, what time do you open? She said, 8. What time do you close? 5. My dad said, I'll be sitting in that chair till you find something. My dad sat in the chair for a whole day, came back the next day, sat there until lunch. He calls him up. I have something. I don't know if you're going to want it. Of course I'm going to want it. I'm starting a family. What is it? It's a job cleaning toilets. My dad did that for 10 years at Nabisco Brand Bread, took a second full-time job cleaning toilets at another bread company. Cooked for a family on the weekend because they wanted my mom to be a stay-at-home mom. Went to night school to get his GED. And then after getting his GED, he went to night school to learn how to operate a small restaurant. Saved his nickels and dime from working two jobs as a janitor. Started a cafe near downtown L.A. Started when he was 47 years old. Ran it until his mid-80s. And retired, he owned that building, property next door, plus the little house that we still have in our family. And my dad always told my brothers and me, hard work wins. You get out of life what you put into it. Larry, you cannot control the outcome, but you are 100% in control of the effort. And before you moan or groan about what someone did to you or said to you, go to the nearest mirror, look at it, and ask yourself, what could I have done to change the outcome? And finally, my dad said, no matter how hard you work, how good you are, sooner or later, bad things are going to happen to you. How you deal with those bad things will tell your mother and me if we raised a man. I tell you that story to say, no matter how badly your race, you still have to be responsible. You still should know right from wrong. As to what to do about this problem, Short term, all these people need mentors. I liken it to AA, where if you're a recovering alcoholic, you have a sponsor. All these men and women who don't have father figures need one. And I'm urging all the people in my generation, I'm the baby boomer generation, people in my generation have retired or about ready to retire. They're vigorous. They've raised their kids. They've raised their grandkids. They have life experience. They have wisdom. You should make yourself available for all these kids to be able to call you when they need to have a strong, commonsensical voice. I belong to a church called the Calvary Chapel Church. My pastor is Jack Hibbs. We have a mentoring program where literally we go door to door in places like Harlem offering mentorships to young people who don't have father figures. I was just campaigning in Iowa. I was at a city called Johnson City, 98% white. And I asked the chief of police whether there was a gang problem. He said, there is. Not like Chicago, we have a gang problem. I said, what's the common theme? He said, the common theme is they don't have they don't have a father figure. Mm-hmm. Not a father, not a grandfather, not a pastor, not a baseball coach, nobody. That's what people need. And I'm urging people to step up and volunteer their time, and if not time, then money for programs. Every city has programs like that. They're all underfunded, understaffed.
Man, yeah, it's such a complicated problem. And sadly, it's not something that is unique to, it's not just unique to the USA at all. I think the US has one of perhaps the highest rate of fatherlessness or single parent households in the world. Sadly, that is one thing I think the US is number one in. But it's also a massive problem across the entire West, mm-hmm. Certainly a big problem in the UK. It's a problem in Australia. It's a problem in Canada, not as severe. Many parts of Western Europe, even some parts of Eastern Europe, and it's spreading to other continents. They're behind in this sense. Behind is good, but it's kind of like obesity. It's this thing that is starting in one place, and unfortunately, the bad ideas and the social and economic conditions and just the overall attitudes and the media programming, it's having real catastrophic effects. And I think one of the issues with this is the impacts are delayed. It's not one of those things where you let it go a certain way or you implement a certain policy or whatever, and you quickly get feedback on what the results are. This is something with a massive time delay. So you can try some experiment right now in 2024 where you fundamentally tweak the way that families operate or communities, something that's been fundamental for thousands of years, and you decide to just tear that apart and put something new in its place and run an experiment. And it might not be until 2050, 2060, when you really start to see and feel the repercussions of all those decisions. I think that right now we're dealing with the consequences of a lot of things that happened in the 1960s and the 1970s. I'm sure some of them, people had good intentions. I mean, if you think like, expansion of welfare policies, for example, mm-hmm. People can have their different theories as to whether that was intentionally to tear apart families and take men out of the households, or did it have good motives? It kind of doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It's the results that matter.
Yes, the results.
And you're right about the 60s. Lyndon Johnson launched the so-called war on poverty. Mm-hmm. At the time, 25%, as I mentioned, of blacks were entering the world without a father in the home, married to the mother. Fast forward, it's now 70%. And I'd like to think with the best of intentions, we've incentivized women to marry the government and incentivized men to abandon their financial and moral responsibility. Mm-hmm. That needs to be rethought.
Do you know what the statistic is for children or maybe black children specifically who are growing up without a father at all? I know the stat for I know the stat for their parents not being married and not right. being together obviously are different things. I'm just wondering if you know what the stat is for the fathers actually just not in the picture.
All I know is that right now, it's a little under 70% of black kids are born into a world without a father in the house, married to the mother.
Yeah.
And at some point, 85% of black kids will be living in a home without a father. 85% at some point.
Oh, okay.
Now, what the pushback will be, I'm on a commission called the Commission on Social Status of Black Men and Black Boys.
Okay.
Donald Trump appointed me to that commission. It was started by a congresswoman, a Democrat from Florida. There are about 30 people on the commission. Only about two or three of them are conservative. And I've said to them what I've said to you. And the pushback I always get is this. It is a myth that black men are absent. If you Google the myth of black fatherlessness, you'll get a whole bunch of hits. Because purportedly, even though a black man is not married to the mother, he comes over and picks the kid up, spends time with them, blah, 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 blah. Well, if that's true, then how do you explain these numbers I just gave you? It's not the same thing as having a father in the house married to your mother, where you see him getting up every day, whether he wants to go to work or not, and you see them responsibly resolving disputes and making decisions in an adult way. Without seeing that, that's the problem. So, again, we incentivized, made it easier for women to have a child without a father in the house. And I think those incentives need to be rethought.
Yeah. It's so difficult because it's generational and things get normalized. Mm-hmm. So if someone grows up in that type of situation where that is just the norm, they assume it's the norm and they are most likely to perpetuate it themselves. And so it's got this cascading effect where it's not just impacting a single generation, it becomes the norm and the default, and people go on and
absolutely
just do the same
there's
thing.
A very long article in a magazine called The Atlantic, which is a left-wing magazine, mm-hmm. and it talked about when you are a young mother or father, all the decisions you have to make. The most important decision, however, according to The Atlantic, is whether or not you're capable of living in a neighborhood where there are a lot of two-parent households. Even if you're a one-parent household, but you're surrounded by two-parent households, it will have a positive effect on how you view the world. Mm-hmm. And the reverse, of course, is true as well. So you're right about it being normalized. Jesse Jackson, his mother was a teenage mom who was impregnated by the married man who lived next door. Mm-hmm. He grew up in South Carolina when it was unusual for a black kid not to have a mother and father in the house. And he was taught it. Jesse ain't got no daddy. Jesse ain't got no daddy. Al Sharpton had a nice middle-class life until his father ran away with another woman, and into the hood he went. Barack Obama's first book was all about the angst he felt by not having his biological father in his life. Last time he saw his biological father, he was 10 years old, and the whole book was about the pain he felt. Louis Farrakhan, his mother was estranged from her husband, had a boyfriend, briefly took back up with the husband, got pregnant with Lewis, and tried to abort him with a coat hanger. Now, I mention this because these are four of the most prominent so-called black leaders in America, all of whom either had no relationship with their own father or a poor one. Yet they talk about racism, racism, racism far more than they talk about the kinds of things you and I are talking about.
Man, it's heavy. Larry, I want to be respectful of your time, man.
You got it.
There is so much that
And don't forget, it's called As Goes California, My Mission to Rescue the Golden State and Save a Nation. Some of the stuff I talk about my dad is in there, about some of the stuff that Zubi and I talk about fatherlessness in there, mm-hmm. and about what we can do to turn around California and turn around the country.
Awesome. And where can people get it?
Amazon.com.
Awesome. Larry, I appreciate you so much, man. Always good to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours, like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more, made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.